Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the V2 Academy. I'm Chris Lappin, and join me as always, I've got Peter Prickett.
Evening.
Yeah, how are you doing this evening, Peter?
Great.
Yeah, so shortly we'll be joined by Laurie McGinley, who is the coach at Motherwell Community Project. But first, we want to quickly discuss the instruction of pass in youth football.
Yeah, it's a common complaint that if you follow timelines of coaches on Twitter, you'll see them often talking about their parents or even other coaches shouting at kids, pass the ball, pass the ball, pass the ball. And I think that almost every coach will have a story about a time when they or someone else was shouting pass and the kid just keeps dribbling, keeps dribbling. Now, of course, that's a little bit embarrassing for the coach, but I think it's more of a problem than that. Something that we talk about is creating decision makers.
Yeah.
So their players to pass the ball and play nice football. They don't want them to lump it. They're actually taking the decision making away. And all they're doing is breeding players who receive the ball, control it and pass it, receive the ball, control it and pass it. And then they're not taking any responsibility. And for me, why I don't shout pass at my players, especially the younger ones, is that I believe that dribbling is a mindset.
Yeah.
So if as a young player you were only ever told to receive it, every time you get the ball, you pass.
Yeah.
You don't take anyone on. And you've got to have a mentality to actually want to take people on. So as you get older and you've always passed,
yeah,
to actually learn that mindset of a player's coming towards me, that's no problem, I can beat him. Rather than a player's coming towards me, I've got to shift this ball quick and give it to someone else. Conversely, we'll be able to deal with a player who's coming towards them, but also can then be coached to pass the ball later. I think it's much harder to go the other way around.
Yeah.
So this instruction of pass, pass, pass will actually take something away from young players. And for the very youngest players, they don't want to pass the ball anyway.
No.
So you're stunting their natural play.
So we're delighted to be joined on the line by Laurie McGinley. How are you doing this evening, Laurie?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well. So what sparked your interest in the game from a young age?
From a young age,
yeah.
I've always been active in all sports.
Mm.
I love football because my sister was involved in football and I liked to play it when I was a young boy. When I was 10 years old, I became very ill. I had encephalitis of the brain, meningitis, and it took me a long time to recover. But through the kind of support of my family and friends and kind of school, and the football team I was working with, playing with, we decided that was going to be kind of my superior thing to kind of work with it, with my confidence.
Yeah.
I played played at a kind of just boys club level, and then at 18 years old I got a letter through the post from the Scottish Disability football team to go and train with them because I had an acquired brain injury. I really enjoyed the training and enjoyed the experience of actually getting to play for my country, which was a great honour. I played for them for 6 years. And I just gave it up last year,
yeah,
just to personal reasons.
Yeah, so I did read that you played Scotland. Did you finish fifth or sixth in a tournament?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So what originally inspired you to become a coach?
Well, when I was 18, 19, I started doing my badges at university, and I like to basically work with children and young people who didn't really have a chance of kind of making it in the game, I thought I'd try and help them out, because the people who invested in me, I would basically give it back to them and help them out as much as I can. Over the last maybe 2-3 years, I've been really upping my game, doing my badges, but also going on licence courses and travelling, you know, up to London to do the Quaver courses, and doing kind of a variety of different football courses and badges, just to try and get more experience, but also meet new people and networking.
So you recently had a spell with Glasgow City. What was the difference between coaching teenage girls and teenage boys?
There's not actually much of a difference, to be honest. I just treat it as a, like, the, when it comes to boys and girls, I just go with exactly the same, and just try and get the best out of them, to help them get better as people, and then get them better as players. There's not much difference in the way they play. It just maybe the girls' game's not getting as much coverage, but it is getting a lot more through to the national team, and also through, you know, England and Scotland, and also the World Cup that happened. It was an amazing watching, you know, football, because at the end of the day, football is an international sport, and it doesn't matter if you have you're a girl, boy, or a disability. It just, it can be enjoyed and played by anyone who wants to just who has the love for the game.
You're currently at Motherwell, that's right.
And that's correct.
Is it a community role?
Yeah, so I work with community. So I work in work with young children, the as young as 3, and then I help take the under 17s at the moment. But over the summer, I got to work with the younger ones and the kind of 3 to 5s, and then the 5 to 7s, and then the 9 pluses. It was just great to have a variety of different children, so I can use my skills to help the other coaches out, but also help the kids out, to help them get better at football, but also, you know, work together as a team more.
It sounds from what you said earlier that your concern is not about any sort of elite level of player. It's just about getting the best out of any player, no matter where they're at, just improving them to get as far as they can. Whether that becomes elite or not, that's not the point. The point is that they are playing, they're improving, and they're enjoying it.
Yeah, all, I would like to one day work at elite level, but right now I work, you know, and help the, you know, people who don't have a lot, you know what I mean, and help them become like better people, but also just the standards. You know what I mean? Like the last couple of weeks has been excellent. You know what I mean? Just asking the players to come in 5 minutes earlier. You know what I mean? Like training starts at 5, be in for 5 to 5, and then we can everything set up for them so they can be playing for playing at 5, and then that way they're just getting better. Like at school, turning up 5 minutes early. You know what I mean? Or staying 5 minutes extra just to get out of that extra bit of work done. And I know the elite level is very demanding and very competitive with coaches and with players, but at the end of the day, everyone's human and they just want to get themselves better at you know, at life, basically, and get themselves better standards so they can get themselves a better kind of better mindset, so they can improve themselves just a little bit better.
How did you get involved with Motherwell in the first place?
I applied for a position in the summer and had a couple of interviews, a practical and a speech, and it clicked really, really well. We got on really, really well, me and the two bosses that I work with, and they seen my ideas and they really liked it. So I'm really happy where I am, and it's such a good honour to be working at a football club.
Is your experience working in with disability, has that become involved within the community work that you do, or is that something further down the line?
I've had to deal with things with children who have disabilities, but I just adapt it the best way I can. So sometimes there could be, in one session, there could be a person who might have a disability, but I'll make sure they're integrated into the session as much as I can, and they are, therefore they feel they can be part of the kind of social inclusion, and therefore the children and the adults and the coaches feel comfortable about what's going on, because obviously I've got experience working with children and adults who have got a disability, but I don't think there's any difference at all. I think everyone, you just have to work with everyone equally and help them the best way they can. If they need some more support, I'm happy to go in and help. I like to lead the session, and then let the other, if the, I'm working with another coach who might feel a bit uncomfortable, just help them out and just say, you know, do this, and help them out to get them more experience.
So within your sessions and your session structures, are there any particular areas that you focus on?
Depends on the, let's just say, the game before. So I analyse the game and see what I can work on. So let's just say if we need to work on midfield support, I'll do a session, a warm-up, which is related to combination play, and then from there I'll build the session up and up and up and drive the intensity, because I believe as a coach, if you have a kind of low intensity, then sometimes the players switch off, but if you have a high intensity, then they can react off you really, really well. Even if they're not playing as well, they still have that extra 5% to try and give you, and then therefore they can help the team a bit more. Every session is planned, so if let's just say the session doesn't go to plan and plan A, I always have a plan B and a plan C, and therefore I can adapt quite quickly to make the sessions more fun. If it's getting a bit, I don't want to say boring, but sometimes it can go flat, you just have a bit of fun and then go back into it and see if they get the ideas. Sometimes it can go simple, then complex, and sometimes the complex can be a bit more difficult, so for some children, so you just have to break it down again, and therefore they can you can work on it, and then the following week you can do something similar, and then the following week it could be something completely different, and then maybe a couple of weeks again, but interacting with the players again and seeing what the best way for them is.
You mentioned the Curva sessions, or the Curva courses. Now, I went a few years ago, and one of the things that I clearly remember was Alf Gullerstein saying, if you can count it, you can introduce an element of competition, and that will always up the levels of intensity. Is that something that you put in? Because you mentioned there about making things, plan C to make things more fun. Is competition one of the ways that you make things more fun?
So I think kids these days want to compete. You know, it might be FIFA. You know what I mean? Maybe they like to have the competition. You know what I mean? But at the end of the day, it could be something just a 5-10 minutes just to get them back into it. I went to all the Quaver stuff, the Diploma 1 and 2, and it was excellent how they adapted things, but it's all about speed. But sometimes the players might not get what's happening. It might be the speed of thought, and it just be a bit slow, but then just a wee bit of fun. Just everyone can back in. We'll do something which will take 2-3 minutes just to get them refreshed and then back in. And I believe the sometimes you have to drive the intensity as a coach, but sometimes you have to leave it to the players to pick the intensity up. But it's just one of them things. I believe, I like Conte and I like Klopp, how they're passionate, but they drive the intensity because they want to do well for the team and help them get so much better. Just that extra 1%, but that extra 1% could either be a goal or a saving challenge.
What have been the biggest influences on your coaching style?
So I like to go to the Inspire guys, John and Jed. They were really, really, I started to follow them, their stuff, and it was really good. But I started to look at some of the guys who are on it, and I started following them. And I like the mindset stuff. You know, I like the variety of different speakers they had, but the best one it was probably in December of last year, where they had such a variety of speakers from like Prozone to different kind of coaches to Alistair McCaw, the guy who does the standards. And me and him, I've spoken to him a few times over the last couple of months about how to get myself better as a coach, but getting myself better so I could help my team out with like different standards. And he was one of the most inspirational guys I've ever kind of met, because it was his session, his talk lasted an hour, and it was 1 hour of just pure brilliance. And the guy was very, very good, but had everyone in his basically back of, in palm of his hands. But he was very, very good, because he just knew how to kind of deal with kind of questions too. I liked the coaching family, how they produce kind of sessions. Also, like there's such a different variety. I use Twitter, and I don't steal ideas. I like to just maybe copy a few and then make it my own, because I know the Sir Alex Ferguson always said he never took a session and just made it his own all the time. But it's the best way to do things, and therefore you can actually adapt the way you want to coach to the needs of your team.
In one of Daniel Coyle's books on talent, one of the rules that he suggests for improvement is to steal unashamedly.
Oh, that's brilliant. I've read that book. It's brilliant. The Talent Code. It's unbelievable. You know what I mean? But it's the books that people are producing right now are brilliant. From Mindset to the Talent Code to even Alistair McCaw's new book's really, really good. But it's all about how you work as a coach. And if you want to steal ideas, it's brilliant, because you just make them out. You can steal ideas to make yourself look good, but then you want the team to look better, and then therefore the kids can buy into what you want to coach.
Yeah, the one on Twitter has been great for session plans being put on there to give people ideas, but there's always got to be the caveat that session was not designed for your players.
Definitely.
So, as great as it might look, you're probably going to need to change it a bit, because it's got to be for your players, and you know what your players need, hopefully.
Definitely, because you've got the people who kind of, you've got Guardiola sessions, and then you've got people try to copy that, and it's never going to have the same effect, because obviously Guardiola is fantastic at what he does, but you can never carbon copy the same session. You just have to make it your own and see if you can you have to change it to make it the session flow, but also how the standard of the players too.
You talked about briefly their mindset. I actually mentioned mindset earlier in the intro. Some people may not quite be sure what is meant. I mean, Carol Dweck in her book actually defines it quite well. I'm wondering if you could just explain to people what you understand it to be.
So I believe it's two things. You've got your growth mindset, which is you want to learn more, so nothing's going to stop you. You just push yourself to make that yourself better, to make everyone else better. But you've got a closed mindset, where you give up, and you just don't want to do it. So I believe if you have a growth mindset, you're always going to succeed. If you have a closed mindset, you are going to succeed, but you're going to hit a barrier, and then therefore you have to try and get yourself working with people who are positive. Therefore, because if you work with people who are negative, then you're going to get yourself down, and therefore you're not going to be as good as a coach, but also not good as a person, and therefore your standards might drop.
So yeah, she talks about growth and fixed mindsets. And for me, when I read it, the biggest thing was actually how people with a growth mindset dealt with setbacks versus how people with a fixed mindset dealt with setbacks. And the fixed people tended to be very protective of their own ego.
Yep.
And took things very personally. The example that that she used quite a lot was John McEnroe. I don't think she was a fan, but her basic thing was that McEnroe's explosions on court, whether he was looking for other people to blame rather than looking at himself and saying, okay, what do I need to do now? That's happened. Now what can I do to make that better? And I think we've had that with some of our footballers in the past.
Yeah.
Looking for other people to blame.
Maybe an incident, like the referee never called a foul, but it was a definite foul. You just go on with it. You know what I mean? Like, you've got, let's just say it's the last 5 minutes of the game and you're 1-0 down and you've the ref had a, let's say, not the best of games. You just say, well, you constitute your own game, and therefore, if you constitute your own game with your team, you might get a goal here. But if you just have that kind of closed mindset where, oh, we've got 5 minutes to go, or we're getting the referee's not helping us, we're not having the best of the games, then you're not going to get that goal. But if you have a growth mindset, then you will potentially get a goal, and then if you actually get a goal within 2-3 minutes, you may actually get a winner. And I think there's a lot of things like that in football at the moment, like the Euros. It was all about the, you know, that last minute goals, and it was brilliant to see.
One of the Premier League games last season, I can recall Arsene Wenger once again blaming the referees for what happened. And it was against Southampton, and Ronald Koeman's response was, he's blaming the referee, but actually he should look at his team, who have had 20 shots and not been able to score any of them. So if you're looking at growth mindset, it's actually, we need to improve our finishing, and then we can't be blaming other people.
Definitely.
What would you think about the growth mindset and accepting that you are, as a player, flawed in some way, or as a manager, flawed in some way, and you have to go and improve that, versus the contradiction we have in sport where players and managers have to have absolute belief in their own abilities? Those two things, it's like you have to switch one on during the game and then switch it off when it comes to training.
Yeah, it's very difficult, because you could have a player who has an unbelievable talent but has a closed mindset, versus a player who wants to be that player but has a growth mindset, and they try and meet in the middle, but it will never happen, because the mindset, obviously everyone's mind's totally different, but it's how you want to work, you know what I mean? And you could have a manager who wants to have the best team, but the players have to buy into the manager, and therefore the players obviously have to buy into the manager's theory and his kind of mindset. And if he's got a growth mindset, then generally the players will go to him. But if the kind of has any doubt, then the players start to feel a bit, you know, not great around the manager, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So if you had a chance to change something within youth development, what would it be?
That's a real difficult question, but I think football there's a lot of money in football at the moment, and there's too much money in football at the moment, but
yeah.
I believe that the top has a lot of money. When it comes down, let's just say it trickles down to the bottom, there's not a lot of money in there. However, you could have a youth coach who does a really, really good job but doesn't get the recognition. You know what I mean? And sometimes, obviously, you've got people, young guys who are 24, 25, 26, might have 3 jobs just to try and get them, you know, a youth coach doing another job and another job, but their passion is football, but they still have to pay the bills.
Yeah.
But they have to try and maybe, you know, look at grade one academies, you know what I mean? Some of these academies, some people are on, let's say, £25,000 over the year, you know what I mean, or £30,000. In Scotland, you know, that's a lot of money. In England, it's not as much, but it's still comfortable for some people. But then, if you look at the bigger clubs, they'll pay managers £4-5 million over a year. And I think the youth development, there has to be a lot. You have to invest in youth, in my eyes, but you have to invest in the managers too. Coaches, because coaches at the end of the day have to have an idea of how they're going to survive, But if the managers are getting paid £4 or £5 million, then the players, obviously, some players are getting paid £300,000 a week, mm-hmm. which is ludicrous. But end of the day, it's a job for some of these players. But that's, I think, that's maybe where I stand with youth development. Also, I think the thing I've seen at the moment, a lot of players are going out on loan. You know what I mean, to lower league clubs, and that's not great. I just listened to another podcast with Stevie Greave, the World Football yeah. Index, and it's really interesting stuff. The gentleman who presents it, saying that one of the boys is going to get signed for Manchester City, but he went to Deportivo La Coruña. Why can't he just play at, you know, Manchester City, play the league games? Yeah, oh sorry, the cup games. Play with a reserve squad, therefore he's getting game time, but also he's integrated with that squad. And I've looked at Chelsea, they've probably spent maybe 20 players on loan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's not a bad thing, you know what I mean? But at the end of the day, who's your club? You know what I mean? Look at some of the Chelsea players that have been on loan 5 or 6 times over the last 5 years.
Christina too has been on loan She was kind of like loan today to Newcastle, I think. The last 3 seasons, it was Bournemouth last season, Everton the season before.
Yeah, and it's just like, why can't they just play in the kind of cup games or integrate them? Because you've got amazing players at Chelsea, Arsenal, but look at them, maybe, don't say the lower league teams, but you know, like the people are not going to be in the Champions League or the Europa League, but they can still challenge for something. End of the day, they need to bring, the youngsters have to try and, challenge for that spot. But then you can just look at the transfer market right now. It's going to be £25 million for a player, and then that youngster's like, I don't know what to do. And I think there's a lot of, you know, youth academies are brilliant in some of these countries, but they have to try and. I think some of the managers are scared that the youth might kind of make a mistake and cost them a game. But then that comes back to your growth mindset. Do you have the trust to? And your players to do well, and I think that's more to do with kind of development, kind of them 2 points.
I think the money has bought laziness and fear.
Yep.
Laziness in that they don't need to develop players because they can just throw some cash at someone.
Yep.
And fear, linked to what you just said there, there's a lot of money at stake, which means that people's jobs are at stake, so they're not willing to take that chance on the young player unless that young player is already arriving as a finished article, which is a huge thing to ask of a young footballer.
Well, definitely, because it's there's so much money, as you said, in football, but the fear they might, let's just say the relegation. You know, obviously there's a lot of money in the Premier League. If you get relegated, you get X amount of money, but you still want to be in the Premier League at the end of the day. But, I would take a gamble, you know what I mean? Because sometimes young people, like Ruben Loftus-Cheek, he made his debut in a Champions League game, and he was brilliant. Pressed the ball. It was great to see. But it was great to see, young players pressing the ball, also try make a name for himself. And obviously you got Conte, and I don't know how his plans are for younger people, but he's kind of seen like he might be doing that kind of thing. But then end of the day, I'm not Chelsea manager, so
Alright, so we'll finish on Ask the Coach, and the question this week's been sent in by Johnny Below. He said, is Rangers being back in the top division good for Scottish football?
Yeah, I think it's good for Scottish football. A couple of reasons why. You've got Hearts, Aberdeen, Rangers, Celtic. The kind of main four getting better.
Yeah.
What's it called? Providing that kind of competition thing. I think Rangers and Celtic make Old Firm. It's great to see it again. I seen the game at Hampden. It was electric, the atmosphere. It was great to see, because I'm not a Rangers or Celtic fan, but it was great to see from a neutral point of view. But I think great to see how the Rangers got on. Obviously, Celtic have started really, really well this season with the good Scott Sinclair. What a great signing for Celtic he was.
Yeah.
But then I like Joey Barton. I think he brings something else to the game. So I believe there is positives and negatives, but I think the positives outweigh the negatives in this kind of scenario. I think for Scottish football, it's great to see Rangers back into the top flight.
How do you think this will help the game going forward?
I think Celtic have done really, really well to get to the Champions League kind of group stages, but then look at Rangers, potentially could win the Cup.
Yeah.
And that would be potentially a Europa League spot. Obviously, there's a lot of kind of five or six rounds before that, but then if Rangers go into that, or even Aberdeen, or Hearts, or any of the teams in the SPFL, it could promote Scottish football so much more. If you've got two teams in Europe,
yeah,
it would help, obviously publicise a bit more, but also money, because obviously there's a lot less money in Scotland. But I believe that's where the youth development kind of helps a lot of it. But
yeah.
I think with Rangers, the support they have, and the fans, I think it's great to see. If they could do really, really well, then you could have two teams in Europe, hopefully. Therefore, you could have one of the magical nights, at Ibrox or at Parkhead or Pontrodry or, Hearts or any of these kind of bigger clubs.
Yeah, so before we go, do you want to plug your social media?
Yeah, it's, my Twitter is Laurie McGinley 1. You'll find me on LinkedIn. I think it's Laurie McGinley 1.
Yeah.
And that's me.
So I've really enjoyed speaking to you today. I'd love to have you on again in the future.
Okay, thanks so much, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, cheers, guys.